At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see now. Obamacare and small investors buying into startups, nuclear power and women's magazines. Yeah, that covers everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 23rd of October. Great to have you here, as always. And the phrase of the day this Wednesday is caveat emptor, buyer beware, brought to us by the good people at the Securities and Exchange Commission, because today the SEC voted to let regular investors, me, you, and pretty much anybody else, buy shares in startups long before they actually go public on the stock market. We could earn a big return if we back the right horse. An early chunk of Twitter would have been lovely, don't you think? But not every company is a Twitter now, is it? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us going from New York.
When Allison Cave and Kevi Bluer needed to raise money for the bakery and cocktail bar they planned to open in Brooklyn, they used a popular new fundraising method.
We launched our Kickstarter campaign about 2 weeks ago.
Cave says they've raised $28,000 so far from hundreds of people.
As of now, and I check it like every 2 seconds, we're at 300 now, which is just incredible.
In return for a pledge, those 300 investors don't get shares, they get stuff. Tote bags, pastries, a free party. But some companies want to use this crowdfunding method to sell shares. Max Wolf is chief investment officer at ZT Wealth. He says there are strict rules about who can buy stock in private companies.
What we've historically said is you have to have the guidance and supervision of a professional, and you have to be a person of well above average means to participate in the opportunities here.
Typically, only investors with a net worth of more than $1 million could be venture capitalists. Wolf says that's made it hard for startups to get financing, and that's part of why companies have been pushing to relax the rules. Today, the SEC made it possible for the average investor to get in on the venture capital action using crowdfunding.
It democratizes the investment process, certainly.
Colin Bladen directs the Tuck Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship at Dartmouth. He says the number of startups that actually pay off for investors is tiny, and this could backfire.
Often these investors are less able to discern between good investment opportunities and bad.
Bladen says these investors won't get the same information they'd get from a company that had gone public and was selling shares on the stock market. So investing in them, even with a crowd, will be a lot riskier. But there is a limit to the losses nouveau venture capitalists will see. The law caps the amount that people can invest in these new companies. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The trials and tribulations of healthcare.gov, the website for the Affordable Care Act, have been well documented. No less a sage than Warren Buffett has called it a huge screw-up. His words there. But now Obamacare has another public relations problem. You remember when the president went out on the stump to get the bill passed and he kept on saying something like this?
If you like your current insurance, you will keep your current insurance.
Well, that's not exactly true, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Critics of the Affordable Care Act are having a field day, or should I say month. Not only is the program's website in need of emergency surgery, the new law is also delivering a shock to some healthcare consumers.
Outrage. It was absolutely outrage.
That's what Deborah Cavallaro says she felt when she got a letter from Anthem Blue Cross a couple weeks ago canceling her policy. Anthem offered her a new one, but with higher monthly premiums. Cavallaro runs her own business in L.A. and bought her own individual coverage, just like 14 million other Americans. Now, hundreds of thousands of those people are getting cancellation notices in light of the new health care law. They're being offered more comprehensive coverage for the most part because that's required under the new law. But Cavallaro says President Obama made her think she could keep her current insurance if she wanted to.
My complaint with the president and the administration is that they are simply not telling the whole truth.
I think it's unfair to blame President Obama for the complexities of the healthcare system.
Dan Mendelsohn is CEO of the healthcare consulting firm Avalere Health.
And frankly, when he was making those statements, he was being asked about employer-based insurance. And generally, we've seen that employer-based insurance is very consistent across the marketplace.
Under the new law, some consumers will end up with individual policies that cost less, others with policies that cost more, like younger people who now have bare bones coverage, says Patrick Johnston at the California Association of Health Plans.
They are sharing the risk pool, if you will, with those people who have more health problems and are sicker.
And consumers like Deborah Cavallaro can comparison shop for coverage in the new state health exchanges. She hasn't investigated that yet. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Speaking of risk pools, the three major indices spent the whole day pretty much underwater. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our education reporter Amy Scott told us yesterday that more than half of all public school students in this country qualify for free or reduced-priced lunches at school. Part of that's because schools are doing a better job of identifying kids who are eligible. Part of it's because the economy is not as robust as we might like, both of which make some sense. But getting kids to actually eat those meals, that can be tough. From the Education Desk at WYPR, here's Amy with part two of her story.
There's a strip mall a couple of blocks from Paint Branch High School in Maryland's Montgomery County. It's got a 7-Eleven, a Pizza Hut, and a Chinese restaurant. And right around 11 in the morning, the students start rolling in. 18-year-old Kelvinisha Palmer, in braids and a baseball cap, hits the 7-Eleven.
So what did you buy today? What's in the bag?
I bought my friend a drink, and then I bought some chicken wings.
How much were they?
$7.77.
Okay, that's a nice round number.
It's also a lot more than the 40 cents she would have paid for lunch at school, where she's eligible for a reduced price lunch. That's because her mom earns less than 185% of the federal poverty level. But Kelvinisha has a part-time job serving food at a retirement home. So today, she skipped the cafeteria and splurged.
I just didn't like what they were having today.
Sorry. What was it today?
I think it was, they're like mozzarella sticks or the beefaroni spaghetti thing.
Judging from the crowd at the strip mall today, a lot of kids didn't like what was on the menu. At Paint Branch, just a quarter of the 2,000 students eat the school meal. Marla Kaplan is head of the Division of Food and Nutrition Services at Montgomery County Public Schools.
It's not just students that are eligible for free and reduced price meals. It's all students. As they get older, it's cooler to go to 7-Eleven and get a meal than it is to go into your school cafeteria. It's just the way kids are.
That's a problem, Kaplan says, because those chicken wings and hot dogs they're eating instead are more expensive and less nutritious than what schools are required to serve. So schools are fighting back. In Montgomery County, they've put kiosks with burgers and fruit in the dining area or outside in the hallway so students never have to enter the dreaded cafeteria. They're also sneaking some nutrition into what looks like fast food.
So, for instance, we take a chicken nugget. It's baked. It's not fried. It's got a whole grain crust.
Somebody's also been watching the Food Network. This year, rural Washington County, west of Baltimore, started serving salad in black plastic bowls instead of paper trays.
For two reasons. One, to get the color pop out of the black plastic. The second was to protect the integrity of the lettuce.
Jeffrey Prue runs the school meals program for Washington County.
Because the moisture from the lettuce would leach through the paper tray, and the lettuce would wilt faster.
Turns out when the salad looks better, more kids want to eat it.
You have to give them a reason to partake in the program, which is it's got to look good, it's got to taste good, it's got to be healthy.
And it can't make you feel like an outcast. In some schools, stigma is a bigger problem than the food.
In the lunch line, who's participating in free and reduced price lunch is supposed to be invisible. But schools often do things that make it visible, accidentally or not, and kids sometimes know.
Jim Weil is president of the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center. If cash changes hands in the lunch line, it's easy to see who pays and who doesn't. So more schools are switching to cashless electronic systems where you enter a PIN number. At breakfast, which is now on the menu at most schools, Weil says things can get even stickier.
Fewer kids eat breakfast. So there's a sense in some schools, particularly as kids get older, that breakfast is, quote, for the poor kids, and the more affluent kids don't eat it.
To get around that, more schools are serving breakfast in the hallway so kids can grab it on the way to class or even in the classroom.
Two hands carrying all your items. Close your milk up so it doesn't spill, please.
In a classroom at Smothers Elementary School in Washington, D.C., third graders grab egg sandwiches, cups of juice, and milk and take them back to their desks to eat. In this high-poverty school, skipping breakfast wasn't about stigma. All kids qualify for free meals. Principal Shannon Feinblatt says when breakfast was served in the cafeteria before class, students just weren't getting to school early enough.
Now kids are coming in on time, so we don't have a high truancy rate, and we don't have a high lateness rate, which is really great.
The links between nutrition and learning are well known, even by a third grader named LaVille.
Today was especially good because the juice cup, it was like filling my brain cells up stronger.
Your teacher must have told you to say that. Why do you think it's important to have breakfast every morning?
So you could pay attention in class and you don't have to raise your hand and just say, I'm hungry.
The trick is how to keep kids this excited about eating at school when they get older and the 7-Eleven starts calling. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The economics of the school lunch are amazingly complicated. We've got more about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
I would say that the site was a direct outgrowth of my extreme annoyance and frustration with women's magazines, both as a consumer of them, but also as an editorial staffer at many of them.
A website called Jezebel, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 54 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 15,413. The NASDAQ erased 22 points, a half percent, finished at 3907. The S&P 500 fell 8 points, also a half percent, closed at 1746. Caterpillar unloaded 6% after cutting its revenue forecast for this year. The company says, quote, significant risks and uncertainties remain in 2014. So moving dirt, not so much. Moving people, pretty good. Boeing soared up 5.3% today. It has now beat earnings expectations 16 quarters in a row. The price of oil settled under $97 a barrel. The U.S. government says crude inventories are higher than expected, and thus ExxonMobil and Chevron each drained 0.4%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The Labor Department is scheduled to release its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. Trains, planes, and automobiles, well, minus the train part, Southwest Airlines and Ford Motor Company report quarterly earnings. And folding. It's not just for laundry anymore. World Origami Days kick off and go until November 11th, so you have plenty of time to master that bird, or sailboat, or Death Star. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I am about to violate my own unwritten rule against mentioning the Christmas shopping season before Halloween is even upon us. But retailers do indeed have the holidays firmly in their sights. eBay has just bought same-day delivery service Shuttle. Amazon is trying to get more customers to sign up for its Prime service because every year the ability to deliver goods quickly and cheaply becomes more important. Sally Herships has that story.
To understand the changes eBay is going through, think back to the early 90s and a delivery service called Urban Fetch. Jen Drexler is Senior VP of Insight Strategy Group, a research and strategy firm for retail.
It would deliver a DVD, which, like, now what are those? And then it would deliver you, like, ice cream with it, or pick up a gallon of milk for you, or send a gift. It's kind of genius.
Drexler says this is the line of business eBay is getting into, the courier industry.
eBay, going from, you know, a grandma somewhere selling off her Beanie Baby collection, is now partnering with stores like Home Depot and Macy's and GNC and Bloomingdale's even.
eBay says it will deliver products in as little as an hour and that it's expanding the service, called eBay Now, to 25 new locations by the end of next year. This way, says Drexler, you can avoid stores, the brick and mortar ones, entirely. Even Google is trying out a delivery service in San Francisco. Ben Schachter is senior internet analyst at Macquarie Securities.
They will literally send a courier out to the store to walk into that store, into that retail store, buy something for you, and bring it to your door.
What is going on?
Effectively, what's going on here is Amazon is disrupting the entire retail industry.
Scott Galloway teaches marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says eBay is trying to compete with Amazon's Prime service, which offers free two-day shipping to its members. Amazon is trying to sell more customers on Prime, where for $79 a year, customers get free shipping. Galloway says it's a great deal for Amazon.
What Amazon Prime is really an entry point or a membership into the Amazon franchise.
Ah, so now they're hoping because I'll get some movies for free while I'm browsing the movie site, maybe there's also a movie I might buy.
Exactly. So even though they lose money on shipping, they make it up in incremental purchases.
Galloway says quick shipping means more customers and more sales. Amazon Prime customers spend more than twice as much as others, and other retailers want a piece of that pie. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
For the first time in something like 20 years, the Brits are going to build a nuclear power plant. It is also, I should mention, the first nuclear plant in Europe since the meltdown at Fukushima. Controversy abounds because it's a nuclear plant, but also because a French-Chinese conglomerate will be doing the building. And the government's line that the plant will be on British soil and ultimately under British control is a hard sell, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
The new plant will create 25,000 jobs, provide a fresh supply of reliable low-carbon power, and pump $25 billion into the British economy. No wonder the Energy Secretary Ed Davey was positively glowing when he broke the news.
This is good news for the economy. It's good news for consumers. It's good news for energy security. It's good news for the environment. And it's good news for jobs.
It sounds too good to be true. It is, say the critics. The deal behind the nuclear facility is radioactive, say the critics. Its malign effects will be felt for years. To attract the foreign investors, the UK has promised them a very high price for the electricity they generate, and for a very long time.
It's a 35-year gamble. We are now locked into a 35-year contract, paying twice the price that we currently pay for our electricity.
Dr. Paul Dorfman of University College London says he doesn't expect the price of electricity to double by the time the power plant is operating. British consumers will be overpaying.
We estimate that the UK consumer will be putting about nearly up to $1 billion a year into French and Chinese pockets.
Psychologically, the deal is a bit of a comedown for the Brits. This UK government propaganda film from the 1950s trumpeted the country's pioneering achievements in nuclear power.
As British scientists toil at the never-ending task of setting the hand of man over the power of the nucleus, the fuel of the universe that keeps the sun and all the stars alight.
Britain built one of the first commercial nuclear power stations on the planet. Today, it is handing over a chunk of its nuclear generating capacity to a company owned by a communist totalitarian state.
I'm not sure that we are entirely comfortable or should be entirely comfortable with the Chinese government essentially running a substantial part of Britain's power sector.
Isabel Hilton is editor of the China Dialogue website.
Well, I don't think that any of us can guarantee the future behaviour of the Chinese government. Many other countries would refuse a contract like this.
It's inconceivable that the US would ever agree to a deal like this, having rebuffed a Chinese attempt to take over the American oil firm Unocal. But then Britain is highly unusual in this regard. It seems supremely relaxed about foreigners snapping up its strategic assets, says Alex Brummer, author of Britain for Sale.
There's been a flood of foreign takeovers in Britain. Almost every bit of infrastructure that we have, four of our big six energy companies are owned by overseas owners. Much of the water is owned overseas.
A Spanish company owns London's main airports. Arabs control some of the key seaports. London buses are run by the Germans. It's only the Brits, with their love of financial wheeler dealing, that would allow this fire sale, says Brummer.
In most other countries, strategic industries such as water, electricity, power, would not be allowed to be taken over.
In defence of its cross-border nuclear deal, the British government says we are open for business. And we not only preach free trade, we practice it. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Women's magazines, Vogue and Cosmo, even O, the Oprah magazine, haven't done all that well in print the past couple of years. Online women's media, though, is a whole different thing. About 6 years ago, Anna Holmes created the very popular women's site, Jezebel.com. It's about as different from Vogue and Cosmo as it could possibly be. She is now also the editor of a new book called The Book of Jezebel. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'll tell you what, this is one of those books where you could, and I did, kill like an hour or two just flipping through it and reading these random entries. It's kind of fun.
You did?
I honestly did.
I'm very happy to hear that because I've described it to other people as something that you pick up and look at, you know, for 15 minutes or so and then put down and then look at later.
Oh, no.
But if you spent a whole hour, that's great.
You get to a couple of entries and then you flip ahead a couple of pages because it's not like you have to actually work to read this thing, right? It's short little blurbs about random topics of, I guess, your choosing, right?
Well, my choosing and also the writers and the editors who work on the site now, who worked on the site when I used to run it. So it's more of a collective endeavor than coming straight from my brain.
I want to explore this idea of a women's website, which is what Jezebel is, and it was when you started. But I want to know how it's where it came from. You know, I mean, you started in women's magazines, right?
Mm-hmm. I started, I didn't start my career in women's magazines, but I certainly...
You came from, right?
Yes. I had worked at Glamour and in Style and Freelance for a number of other places, and I was...
And did you not like them? Is that why Jezebel is what it is? I mean, how did we get here?
I would say that the site was a direct outgrowth of my extreme annoyance and frustration with women's magazines, both as a consumer of them, but also as an editorial staffer at many of them. There was a formula that we had to follow, and I understand why that was the case. These women's magazines bring in a lot of money for their parent companies, but I felt that they were oftentimes dumbed down for the readers. They were patronizing,
and
lose 10 pounds.
Consumerist, right? Getting you to buy something.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not that I have a problem or had a problem with purchasing clothes or makeup, but the reason that these magazines made so much money was because they had a large readership and then they made a lot of money from advertisers like, you know, CoverGirl or Maybelline or what have you. But I think that also meant that they were reluctant to push the envelope in any sort of meaningful way.
I'm going to flip through this thing and just come to a random page. Honestly, it's a random page. And I'm going to just read off some of the entries. And I want you to, tell me why they're there and if there's a common thread.
Okay.
So I'm on page 66, and it's Clueless, 1995 cult classic written and directed by Amy Heckerling.
Yeah. Well, Clueless is just a movie that... almost every woman of a certain generation or generations has seen and loves and references and quotes quite often. It was also something that you found in the comment section of the site a lot of the time. That's kind of a nostalgia type entry. And we found that nostalgia type stories on the site always did very well. So that's why that entry is there.
Grey's Anatomy, initially appealing television show about how to survive in a workplace where you accidentally, no, really, screwed your boss before you started the job, launched 1,000 terrible Katherine Heigl vehicles, but gave us Dr. Bailey, so we'll call it even. And I'm with you there, actually. do you think about, yes, I watch Grey's Anatomy, leave me alone.
that's okay.
Do you think about the men who read your site and this book?
I didn't really think about the men who read the site when I was running the site. I was surprised when it became apparent that there were a significant number of men who were reading it, and I was not only surprised but pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm. I didn't think too much about the men with regards to this book either, because I really had to just make a book in the same way that when we made the website that I thought would be entertaining, not just to me, but to the people that I know and the readers that we had. And some of those readers are men, but the majority of them are female. And I don't think that we were excluding men in the book, but they were not my first concern.
It's called The Book of Jezebel. It's edited by Anna Holmes, who started the website called Jezebel. Anna, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
His final note on the way out, in which the federal government gets a rare financial crisis legal win. A jury in Manhattan found Bank of America guilty of a single count of civil fraud today. Defective mortgages sold by Countrywide Financial, the subprime lender that B of A bought in 2008 as the crisis was gathering. The feds are asking for $850 million in damages, which is what they say Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lost when Countrywide unloaded the bad loans on them. And not that this is dispositive, as lawyers like to say, but B of A might have known it was in trouble when it learned the nickname that Countrywide used for the mortgage packages. They called it Hustle. What could possibly go wrong, right? All right, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 54 points. The NASDAQ erased 22 points. The S&P 500 down 8 points. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.